A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's exactly the kind of question that separates a project you build once from a project you rebuild every 18 months. He's asking about Life Apia's batteries for 12 to 24 volt hobbyist and project use, what capacities make sense, how to actually connect them with XT60 adapters, how to charge them properly, and whether to buy pre-built or go with bare cells.
You've probably killed a few lithium-ion packs by over-discharging or leaving them fully charged. The chemistry just punishes that. Life Apu doesn't.
That's the hook right there. With solar generators, portable power stations, and DIY off-grid projects absolutely everywhere now, the battery chemistry you pick is the single biggest determinant of whether your power supply lasts 2 years or 10.
Most people don't realize they're making that decision by default every time they grab whatever's cheapest on Amazon. Leafy Pore, lithium iron phosphate, is the workhorse chemistry, and it earns that reputation in ways that are genuinely surprising if you've only ever dealt with standard lithium ion.
Where do we start? The chemistry itself, I think. Because Life Apu gets lumped in with lithium ion, as if it's all the same thing, and it's really not.
Life Apu is a specific subchemistry of lithium ion. The stuff in your phone, your laptop, most power tool batteries, that's lithium cobalt oxide. Most electric vehicles use NMC, nickel manganese cobalt. Life Apu replaces the cobalt with iron and phosphate, and that swap changes basically everything about how the battery behaves.
Cobalt is expensive, ethically messy to source, and thermally, let's say excitable.
That's one way to put it. Cobalt oxide cathodes can enter thermal runaway at around 150 degrees Celsius. Life PFUS doesn't break down until well over 270 degrees. You basically can't make a Life APOT cell catch fire by overcharging it. The phosphate-oxygen bond is just too stable.
Which is why you see Life points in home battery walls and server rack backups where don't burn the house down is a hard requirement.
The thing that really matters for hobbyist projects is the voltage curve. A standard lithium-ion cell has a nominal voltage of 3.7 volts, swinging from 4.2 volts at full charge down to about 3 volts when nearly empty. Life Apu has a nominal voltage of 3.2 volts per cell, and here's the key. It stays near 3.2 volts from about 90% state of charge all the way down to 20%.
That flat discharge curve is a gift for voltage regulation. If you're building a 12-volt system, four Life Apu cells in series give you 12.8 volts nominal, and it barely budges. Your downstream electronics aren't constantly compensating for a sagging input.
Compare that to lead acid, where a 12-volt battery drops from 12.7 volts fully charged to 11.5 under load. Or standard lithium ion, where a 3-cell series pack swings from 12.6 volts down to 9. Regulating that is a headache. Life Apu just sits there at 12.8 hour after hour until it's nearly drained.
Then there's the cycle life, which is where the workhorse label really comes from.
A good Life Apu cell is typically rated for 2,000 to 5,000 cycles to 80% capacity retention. A standard lithium ion pack, think the one in your cordless drill, is doing well to hit 500 cycles before it's noticeably degraded. Lead-acid deep-cycle batteries, if you're careful about depth of discharge, may be 300 to 500.
You're looking at roughly an order of magnitude more cycles. If you cycle a Life Apu pack once a day, you're talking 5 to 10 years before it hits 80% capacity. The same daily cycling kills a lead-acid battery in 18 months.
That's before we talk about usable capacity. With lead-acid, you really shouldn't discharge below 50% if you want any kind of lifespan. The Pukert effect and sulfation punish deep discharges hard. So a 100 amp hour lead acid battery only gives you about 50 amp hours of actual usable energy. Life Apu happily runs at 80% depth of discharge, so that same 100 amp hours delivers 80 usable amp hours. you'd need a 160 amp hour lead acid battery to match it, and it would weigh twice as much.
Which brings us to the practical side of Daniel's question. With that chemistry foundation, let's get concrete. What sizes do these batteries actually come in, and how do you hook them up to your project?
The capacity ladder is worth understanding because it's not just bigger is better. It's about matching the battery to what you're actually powering. For 12-volt projects, you're building a 4-cell series pack, 4S in the shorthand, and the sweet spot is the 100 amp hour size.
Why 100 amp hours specifically?
It's where weight and usable energy cross in a way that makes sense for most builds. A 12-volt 100 amp hour LiFePO point pack weighs about 13 kilograms, call it 28 pounds, and stores roughly 1.28 kilowatt hours of energy. That's enough to run a 50-watt LED light strip for about 20 hours, or a 12-volt camping fridge for 2 to 3 days. And it's still light enough that one person can lug it around without regretting every life choice.
Whereas the lead acid equivalent to get the same usable energy would be a 160 amp hour deep cycle, which weighs closer to 45 kilograms and takes up twice the footprint.
Costs about the same up front, which people don't expect. A decent lead acid deep cycle in that size runs $250 to $350. The LiFePO is $500 to $900 pre-built, but it lasts 5 to 10 times longer. The math favors lithium hard once you look past the sticker price.
What about the smaller capacities? Not every project needs a car battery-sized brick.
The common sizes cascade down from 100 amp hours, 50, 20, 10, 5. A 20 amp hour pack is great for portable ham radio setups or powering a Raspberry Pi cluster in the field. A 10 amp hour pack can run LED lighting for a weekend campsite. The 5 amp hour sizes are basically what you'd use for small sensor nodes or backup power for a single board computer.
On the other end, 200 amp hours exists, but at that point you're dealing with something that weighs 25 kilos, and you're probably better off paralleling 200 amp hour packs instead. Easier to move, easier to replace a single unit if something fails.
For 24 volt projects, you jump to 8 cells in series, 8S, giving you 25.6 volts nominal. The common capacities there are 50 and 100 amp hours. 24-volt systems are less common in pure hobbyist builds, but they're standard in marine and RV setups and small off-grid solar. Higher voltage means lower current for the same power, so your wiring can be thinner and your losses lower.
Daniel also asked about connectors, and this is where a lot of people trip up. They buy a battery and then realize they have no clean way to plug it into anything.
The XT60 connector is the de facto standard for hobbyist power connections, and for good reason. It's rated for 60 amps continuous with a brief surge tolerance up to about 80 amps. It's polarized, you can't plug it in backwards, and it locks securely with a physical detent. You're not going to accidentally yank it loose.
They're soldered, not crimped. That matters, because a bad crimp on a high current connector creates resistance, which creates heat, which creates, well, problems.
If soldering XT60s isn't your thing, pre-crimped XT60 pigtails are widely available from Adafruit, SparkFun, and across the hobbyist supply chain. The connector was originally designed for RC drone and plane batteries, but it's been adopted across the entire maker ecosystem because it's just a solid design.
The specific adapter Daniel mentioned, XT60 to 2-pin, that's the bridge between the hobbyist battery world and the screw terminal world that most project hardware lives in.
The XT60 side plugs into your battery. The 2-pin side is typically a 5.5mm by 2.1mm barrel jack. The standard DC barrel connector you see on everything from LED drivers to small inverters. Some versions terminate in bare wire leads instead, which gives you more flexibility. Adafruit product number 5024 is the canonical example. It's an XT60 to 2-pin screw terminal adapter, so you land your wires under screws and you're done.
That adapter is the thing that lets you go from, I have a battery, to my project is running on battery power, in about 30 seconds.
Here's the part people skip that they absolutely should not skip. Put a fuse or a circuit breaker between the battery and the adapter. XT60 connectors handle 60 amps, but if that adapter cable gets pinched or the barrel jack shorts internally, your LiFePO battery can dump hundreds of amps into a dead short almost instantly. The internal resistance on these cells is extremely low, sometimes under 10 milliohms. A short across a fully charged 12-volt 100-amp-hour pack could theoretically push over 1,000 amps for a split second before the BMS trips. That's enough to weld the connector contacts together before the protection kicks in.
Which is the kind of failure where you don't get a second chance. A $20 inline fuse holder with a properly sized blade fuse is the cheapest insurance you'll ever buy.
A practical setup looks like this. Battery with an XT60 output, connected to an XT60 to 2-pin adapter, with an inline fuse on the positive lead between the battery and the adapter. Then the 2-pin side goes to your charge controller, your inverter, your LED driver, whatever the load is. Clean, modular, and if something goes wrong, the fuse blows instead of the wiring.
The BMS is the silent partner in all of this. Every LifePPOT battery, pre-built or DIY, has a battery management system that's watching cell voltages, pack current, and temperature. It's the thing that prevents overcharge, over-discharge, and short circuits at the pack level. The fuse is your last line of defense. The BMS is your first.
The BMS is so critical that I'd say it's the single component you should never cheap out on. A bad BMS will let one cell drift high while the others lag, and over time that imbalance kills the pack. A good BMS, something from Daily, JBD, or Overkill Solar, does active balancing, low temperature charge cutoff, and overcurrent protection. The difference in cost between a junk BMS and a quality one is maybe $30. The difference in outcome is a battery that lasts 10 years versus one that dies in 18 months. One thing I want to nail down about the XT60 to 2-pin adapter, because I've seen it trip people up, there are actually two common variants, and they're not interchangeable. The barrel jack version, 5.5 by 2.1 millimeter, is rated for about 5 amps max. If you try to pull 20 amps through one of those, the barrel connector itself becomes a heating element.
Which is a lesson usually learned by smell.
The other variant terminates in bare wire or ring terminals, and that's the one you want for anything drawing more than 5 amps. You land those directly onto the screw terminals of a charge controller or fuse block, and the current path is limited by your wiring gauge, not the connector.
The barrel jack version is for low current stuff, LED strips, small pumps, microcontroller projects. The bare wire version is for everything else. And Daniel, if you're listening, Adafruit's 5024 is the screw terminal flavor, which is the more versatile of the two.
Let me give you a real-world setup that ties all of this together. A 200-watt solar panel feeding an MPPT charge controller set to a LifePPOT profile. The controller output goes to a 12-volt 100-amp-hour battery. The battery's XT60 output connects to an XT60 to ring terminal adapter with a 30-amp inline fuse on the positive lead. The ring terminals land on a DC fuse block, and from there you branch out to a 12-volt camping fridge, some LED lighting, and a USB charging panel.
That's the kind of setup where you can run a fridge for a weekend, lights for a week, and the whole thing fits in a plastic ammo crate.
If you built the same system with lead acid, you'd need 150 amp hours of battery to get the same usable capacity. The whole thing would weigh twice as much, and you'd be replacing the battery every 2 years instead of every 10.
The weight difference is worth underscoring. 100 amp hour life pour at 13 kilos is something you can mount on a wall bracket or tuck under a desk. The lead acid equivalent at 45 kilos needs a floor and a reinforced shelf and a plan for what happens if it tips.
Lead acid off gases. Hydrogen when charging. Not a lot, but enough that you need ventilation. LifePPOT is sealed. No off-gassing, no maintenance. You install it, and you basically ignore it for a decade.
That's the workhorse pitch in one sentence. Now that you know what to buy and how to connect it, the next question is how to keep it alive, and whether you should build it yourself or buy it ready-made.
This is where the just use whatever charger you have lying around. Instinct will absolutely ruin your day. LifePPOT needs a charger with a dedicated LifePPOT APO. The absorption voltage for a 12-volt pack, 4 cells in series, is 14.4 to 14.6 volts. That's 3.6 to 3.65 volts per cell.
A standard lithium-ion charger is targeting 4.2 volts per cell. So, if you plug a 4-cell LifePPOT pack into a charger meant for standard Li-ion, it's going to push 16.8 volts into cells that are designed to max out at 14.6.
Best case, the BMS sees the overvoltage and disconnects the pack before damage occurs. Worst case, you don't have a BMS or it fails to trip, and you're overcharging iron phosphate cells to voltages they were never designed to handle. You'll get gas generation, electrolyte decomposition, and permanent capacity loss. You won't get a fire, the chemistry is too stable for that, but you will get a dead battery.
The charger has to explicitly say life epoch on it, or have a selectable profile.
After the absorption phase, the charger drops to float voltage, 13.6 to 13.8 volts for a 12-volt pack. That's the maintenance voltage that keeps the battery topped off without overstressing it. And this is where life epoch diverges from lead acid in a way that changes how you should think about charging habits entirely.
Lead acid punishes you for not charging to full. The sulfation starts the moment you leave it sitting at partial charge.
LifePep all bulk doesn't sulfate. There's no lead and no sulfuric acid electrolyte to form sulfate crystals. Partial state of charge operation is not just tolerated, it's actually better for the cells. Cycling between 20 and 80% state of charge can push cycle life past 5,000 cycles. You only need to charge to full occasionally for the BMS to recalibrate its state of charge tracking and do cell balancing.
The old instinct of plug it in and let it hit 100% every time is actively shortening the lifespan of a LifePoll Points pack. The battery wants to live in the middle of its range.
A 100 amp hour pack charging at 0.5C, that's 50 amps, goes from empty to full in about 2 hours. But if you're only topping up from 40 to 80%, you're looking at under an hour. With solar, you just set your charge controller to stop at 14.2 volts instead of 14.6, and you're operating in the longevity sweet spot without thinking about it.
What about temperature? I've seen people charge these in unheated garages in winter and then wonder why the pack stopped working.
That's the one hard rule with LifePaus: do not charge below 0 degrees Celsius. 32 Fahrenheit. The internal resistance spikes, and instead of intercalating into the anode, lithium ions plate onto the surface as metallic lithium. That plating is permanent, it reduces capacity, and in extreme cases it can grow dendrites that puncture the separator and cause an internal short.
The battery isn't going to explode, but you're slowly destroying it from the inside every time you charge it cold.
This is where a quality BMS earns its keep. Units from Daily, JBD, and Overkill Solar include low temperature charge cutoff. They sense pack temperature via a thermistor and simply refuse to allow charging current below zero. Discharge is fine down to about minus 20 Celsius, so you can still use the battery in cold weather. You just can't charge it until it warms up.
Which, for a solar setup, means either bringing the battery inside or buying one with built-in heating pads. Some of the Battleborn and Renogy units have those now.
Which brings us to the pre-built versus DIY decision. Pre-built batteries from Dakota Lithium, Battleborn, Renogy. These come in sealed IP65-rated enclosures with integrated BMS, often with Anderson PowerPole or screw terminal outputs, and they carry warranties. A 100 amp hour 12 volt pre-built runs roughly $500 to $900. Battleborn's 100 amp hour unit is around $950 with a 10-year warranty.
On the DIY side?
Prismatic LifePoll cells, the big rectangular blocks, are commonly available in 3.2 volt sizes at 100, 200, and 280 amp hours. To build a 12-volt 100-amp-hour pack, you buy four 100-amp-hour cells, which currently run about $200 to $300 total. Add a quality BMS for $50 to $100, plus bus bars, a compression fixture, and an enclosure. You're looking at maybe $350 all-in versus $950 for the Battleborn.
You save about $600. What's the catch?
If you don't torque the bus bars evenly, you get hot spots. If you don't compress the cells properly, they swell slightly with each cycle and delaminate internally over time. If you wire the balance leads wrong, the BMS can't do its job. And if you skip the compression fixture entirely, which a lot of first-time builders do, you're taking a battery that could last 10 years and turning it into one that lasts 3.
The DIY route makes sense if you're comfortable with the electrical work and you're willing to invest the time to do it right. But for a first LifePoll project, the pre-built removes the most common failure points.
The warranty matters. If a Battleborn battery fails in year 7, you get a replacement. If your DIY pack fails in year 2 because you bought a cheap BMS that didn't balance properly, you're buying new cells.
Let's put hard numbers on the workhorse reputation. A single 100-amp-hour LifeBock cycled daily to 80% depth of discharge. That's 3,650 cycles over 10 years. Still has 80% of its original capacity at the end. A lead acid deep cycle doing the same daily cycling is dead in about 500 cycles, which is under 2 years.
Total cost of ownership flips the upfront price argument completely. $950 for a Battleborn that lasts a decade is $95 per year. A $300 lead acid that lasts 2 years is $150 per year. And that's before you account for the fact that you need a bigger lead acid battery to get the same usable energy.
The expensive battery is actually the cheap one. It just takes a spreadsheet to see it. All of that technical detail is useful. But let's boil it down to three things you can do this week to get started with LifeHobbia.
First, for a first project, buy a pre-built 12-volt 100-amp-hour battery with an integrated BMS and an XT60 pigtail. The pre-built removes the two most common failure points in DIY builds, bad BMS wiring and unbalanced cells that never got a proper top balance before assembly. You unbox it, you connect it, it works.
If it doesn't work, you call someone and they send you another one. That's not a small thing when you're trying to get a project off the ground, and you don't want to spend a weekend debugging a cell balance issue.
Second, use a charger or charge controller that explicitly has a LifePunta profile. This is non-negotiable. A standard lithium-ion charger pushes 4.2 volts per cell, which will overcharge a lift point pack and either trigger the BMS cutoff or damage the cells. The charger needs to say lift points 1 on it, or it needs a selectable chemistry profile. If you're using solar, set your MPPT controller to the LifePause preset and verify the absorption voltage is 14.4 to 14.6 volts.
I'd add that this is the mistake I see most often in forum posts. Someone buys a nice LifePouch pack and then plugs it into the charger from their old lead acid system or a generic lithium charger and then can't figure out why it won't charge past 80% or why the BMS keeps tripping.
The BMS tripping is doing its job. It's the battery telling you the charger is wrong. Listen to it.
Third, if you do go the DIY route and build from prismatic cells, the BMS is not the place to save $20. Get something from Daily, JBD, or Overkill Solar with low temperature charge cutoff and active balancing.
Active balancing matters more than people realize. Passive balancing just burns off excess voltage from the highest cell through a resistor. It's slow and it wastes energy as heat. Active balancing shuffles charge from high cells to low cells, which means your pack stays balanced even if you never charge to full. For a battery that's going to spend most of its life between 20 and 80% state of charge, active balancing is the difference between cells that drift apart over months and cells that stay within millivolts of each other for years.
Low temperature cutoff is the thing that keeps you from accidentally destroying the pack the first time you leave it in a cold garage overnight, and the charge controller kicks on at dawn.
Those features together add maybe $30 to $50 to the BMS cost. Replacing four prismatic cells because one drifted low and reversed under load costs $200 to $300. The math is not complicated.
While we're giving rules of thumb, size your battery so your daily depth of discharge stays under 80%. Ideally under 50% if you want to maximize cycle life. A 100 amp hour battery should not regularly discharge more than 50 amp hours per day.
That 50% target sounds conservative, but it's where the cycle life curve really flattens out. If you cycle between 30 and 80% state of charge, so 50% depth of discharge, you're looking at well over 5,000 cycles. At 80% depth of discharge, you might get 3,000. Both numbers are excellent compared to lead acid, but the difference is several years of additional service life.
The nice thing is, you don't need to obsess over hitting exactly 50%. The battery doesn't care if you go to 55 or 45. It's a guideline, not a curfew. The point is just don't run it to the BMS cutoff every single day and call it normal operation.
If you find yourself regularly hitting the low voltage cutoff, you didn't size the battery correctly for your load. Buy a bigger battery or reduce your consumption. Running a LifePoya pack until the BMS disconnects it is like driving your car until the engine seizes and calling that your refueling strategy.
That's an image I'm going to enjoy. So, to recap, buy pre-built for your first project, use a LifePoya specific charger, and if you build your own, spend the money on a real BMS. Plus the sizing rule. 50% daily depth of discharge as your design target. None of this is complicated, but all of it is the difference between a battery that outlasts your enthusiasm for the project and one that becomes the reason you abandon it.
One open question I keep coming back to. With cell prices now around $80 to $100 per kilowatt hour, we're approaching the point where LiFePO-PiOpsi is cheaper than lead acid on a per cycle basis. So will we actually see these replace lead acid in automotive starting batteries?
The C-rate limitation is the barrier, right? Starting an engine pulls hundreds of amps for a few seconds. Most LiFePO cells are rated for 1C continuous. That's 100 amps from a 100 amp hour pack, and maybe 3C for a brief surge.
A car starter can draw 300 to 500 amps for a couple of seconds on a cold morning. You'd need a LiFePO PP pack rated for that surge, or you'd need to oversize the battery just to handle the peak current. There are high-discharge LiFePO cells that can do 10C or more, but they're more expensive and trade off some energy density to get there. The standard 1C prismatic cell that makes so much sense for solar and hobbyist builds is not the right tool for cranking an engine.
For now, the starting battery stays lead acid, and the house battery goes lithium. That's already the standard in RVs and boats, a dual battery system where each chemistry does what it's best at.
I think that split is going to hold for a while. But the broader landscape is shifting. Sodium ion batteries are emerging as a real alternative. Cheaper raw materials, no lithium, no cobalt, no nickel, and they can be discharged to 0 volts without damage, which is something even LiFePO-PiOpsi can't do.
Sodium is basically table salt. The supply chain isn't geopolitically fraught the way lithium is.
And sodium ion cells have better low temperature performance. They can charge below freezing without the lithium plating risk. The trade-off right now is lower energy density and a shorter cycle life than LiFePO. We're seeing maybe 3,000 cycles versus 5,000 plus for iron phosphate. But the cost curve is steep, and several Chinese manufacturers are already shipping sodium ion cells for stationary storage.
The question is whether sodium ion eats LiFePO's lunch in the next 5 years.
I think for hobbyist and small off-grid projects, LiFePO is safe for at least the next 3 to 5 years. The ecosystem is just too established. Chargers, BMS units, enclosures, connectors, the whole supply chain is built around 3.2 volt iron phosphate cells. Sodium ion operates at a different voltage range, so none of that infrastructure transfers directly, and cycle life still matters more than upfront cost for something you're going to install and forget about.
The workhorse doesn't get replaced by the first cheaper option that shows up. It gets replaced when the cheaper option is also more capable, and we're not there yet.
Next time you're speccing a power supply for a 12-volt project, ask yourself, do I want to replace this battery in 2 years or in 10? That's the real question Daniel's prompt gets at, and the answer is almost always LiFePO.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s, a Scottish carpenter on the Isle of Lewis built a mechanical tide predicting computer out of discarded clock parts and fishing line. It used a series of pulleys and cams to some 10 harmonic constituents and could forecast tides for any date within a 19-year cycle. The device was lost in a barn fire in 1937, and no photographs of it survive.
A tide computer made a fishing line.
That's somehow the most Outer Hebrides sentence I've ever heard.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the question.
If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.